Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now we're in depth on what it means when a family history is erased. That's what happened to the Africans who were sold into slavery and antebellum America, generations of people who were disconnected from their ancestral roots. But there was complicity, not just on the part of Southern slaveholders, also on the part of African slave traders. Writer Yah Jessie understood the harsh implications of that when she traveled to Ghana to research her first novel. So as she joins us, I'm interested in whether you've had an experience of going back to the towns of ancestors and understanding more about the tribulations of those people, the hard choices that they made, and what it reveals to you about your family today. I know we have a lot of Scandinavians in the area, so maybe that's the ancestral root tracing that you've done. But have you had that experience of going back, living in that landscape, visiting that landscape, understanding the tough choices that ancestors made, the lives that they led? That would fit in nicely to our conversation today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Yah Jessie's novel is titled Homegoing, and she joins us today. And Yah, I don't even know where you're at, so welcome. It's good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're in New York City where you live now. Is that right?
I'm in New York City. I'm here doing some book tour stuff. Okay. But I live in Oakland, California.
I'm glad you had time for us. Good to have you. You know, I think it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be missing all of that knowledge about your ancestors. You know, to not know who your mother's people are or who that great-great-uncle was that influenced the way you understand your family today. And I know you've done some thinking about that. What have you concluded about that?
Right. I think that was one of the hugest tragedies of the slave trade, is the way that it fractured these families in kind of irreconcilable ways. You know, you have a group of people who not only were ripped from the land that they came from, but were ripped from each other in permanent ways. And so a lot of the times, you know, you have African Americans who can't trace their families back past their grandparents or their great grandparents or what have you. And for me, as an African immigrant, you know, I always knew that I could go back to Ghana. You know, I could go back to that country and have a sense of myself and my family. But that isn't the case for a lot of people.
Okay, when you say that you knew you could go back there, I mean, knowing that and saying, this is a piece of myself that I could better understand by traveling there, or I might someday decide to experience what it's like to live here? What did you mean?
Yeah, both those things, I think. You know, it is a part of who I am, my Ghanaian identity. And if I wanted to go back and live there, I would have family to support me. I would have, you know, this infrastructure that kind of would allow me to do so comfortably. And if I wanted to go back to visit, it kind of only enriches my experience and my sense of myself. But I think for a lot of people whose families came here under different circumstances, under the circumstances of slavery, you know, that becomes much more complicated.
See, I was thinking about this and I thought, I don't know that those of us who can trace, you know, our roots back four generations, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it's just interesting from a genealogical standpoint, but I also don't think that we think too often about how the mythology of the family grows up around that, right? And what it means to just have an absent couple of generations. I mean, there is nothing I loved more than talking to my dad's mother, my Grandma Miller, about what it meant to have a part of our family come from this place in Scotland and how she owned that and how she kind of incorporated that into who we were. You know, as Millers, and it sounds like you've had a similar experience with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In 2009, when I began writing this novel, I took a trip to Ghana in order to conduct research for it. And I had been to Ghana before. I left when I was 2, and I'd been before with my whole family when I was 11. But this time, when I went when I was 20, I got a chance to kind of see Ghana on my own terms, to talk to family members that I, hadn't ever gotten a chance to really talk to, and to get a lot of these kinds of familial stories that I never got to hear about. And that totally just enriched this experience for me and made me want to write a book that was mostly about family, at its root about family.
Call here from Mark in Chanhassen. Hi, Mark. You sound like you've had an interesting experience with this.
Yeah, it really was, Carrie. It was kind of what I call a Madeleine Albright experience where, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I found out about Jewish heritage that I was unfamiliar with. So that all led to a bunch of genealogy, and we had a big family reunion in the Czech Republic this last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a history major, so I was aware of a lot of this. But what really got to me was seeing in person how many people had either been in the camps or had parents had been in the camps. And then, as soon as they'd gotten back to the Czech Republic, of course, the communists came right after that.
Right.
And then, so most of them had fled either in 39 or 68. And it was just, I was intellectually aware of it, but it really hit me personally.
How do you think it changed the perception of who you are and where you come from, in that ancestral kind of idea?
I guess I started to take it personally.
The history of it? Yeah.
I don't know that it, I can't say it changed me personally a lot, but it just really affected me to know that. It's one thing to understand all intellectually that, all this stuff happened and I'm aware of it. But when you see it in person and meet people whose parents have been in camps, that kind of thing, that, really hits home.
I appreciate the call, Mark. Yeah, I would guess that resonates with you, that when the history becomes quite personal.
Oh, absolutely. Again, when I took that trip to Ghana in 2009 and got to walk the halls of the Cape Coast Castle, this slave fort where they kept slaves before sending them through the Middle Passage, it really affected me, as well as the other tourists who were there. And I thought, what a amazing and awful experience to kind of stand in these rooms and to imagine your ancestors in them.
How old were your parents and how old were you when the family left Ghana to go to? It's Alabama, isn't it?
We kind of traveled all over America. We left when I was 2. My parents were in their 20s.
Okay.
And we lived in Ohio, Illinois, Tennessee, and then moved to Alabama when I was 9.
What do you remember about settling in Alabama at age 9 and what that was like for your parents?
I remember it being quite a culture shock,
I'll bet.
Yeah, when we lived in Ohio, at least, there was a really large Ghanaian-American population, and so we were kind of surrounded by a lot of people who felt familiar to us and, shared the same cultural background, the same foods, the same history. And the more we moved along, the less that became true. And by the time we got to Alabama, there were very, very few other Ghanaian families or West African families around. And we kind of had to forge that identity for ourselves.
So sometimes in a family, when you're feeling isolated, which is, I think, what you're describing in Alabama, mm-hmm. the family pulls in and becomes more insular. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes the family, just by desperation and determination, has to reach out. Which was it for your family?
My family is definitely the reaching out kind of family. Whenever we moved to a new place, my father would pull out the phone book and look up Ghanaian-sounding last names.
Did he really?
And if they were anywhere close, he would give them a call. And so, we would find ourselves driving 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours out of town to meet up with families that he had just reached out to. Community is really important to us and to my family, and I think that was why.
So you probably have a memory of some of these awkward Ghanaian family to Ghanaian family encounters where you know, the first 30 minutes, this is really going to feel weird, right, getting to know these people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the beginning, especially for the children, I think it's you're just kind of like, why are we doing this? But for the adults and later on, I think for the children, you know, you kind of understand the vitality of that and the importance of that, of kind of being able to build community wherever you go.
Yeah. So as you've gotten older, and you've probably reminisced about this with your parents, have they been more candid with you about that this was really hard times for the family? I mean, lots of opportunity, but sacrifices were being made here to do this for the kids.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I understood it, but I understood it in you know, a kind of a vague and not very visceral way. And I think the older I've gotten and the more I've talked to my parents and kind of, you know, been able to see them as they've lived and worked, I've gained a better understanding of how much they've sacrificed, you know, to get us to where we are today.
So when we've talked about what that's like for the first generation, right, of kids mm-hmm. that come in with parents or are born here from another place, mm-hmm. you know, that theme of sacrifice is, you experience that probably in a way that American families who have not had an experience of some kind of immigration in the family experience it. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's just, it's difficult to kind of wrap your head around what it might be like to, you know, leave your home country, your home language, your food, everything, and try to forge a new life on new soil, and all the difficulties that come with that. And I think it can be a really isolating experience, which again is why so many immigrants kind of seek out their fellow homeland countrymen and just try to build community in that way.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing when Americans see that, they interpret that as, well, these are people that don't really want to assimilate into American ways. And there's a big piece of the equation that's left out of that. And that's what you're describing, I think, how isolating it can be.
Yeah, I think it's just a sense of loneliness kind of drives that. You know, you want to be reminded of home. And I think that would be true for any American who traveled and found themselves in a different land as well.
Was there an expectation for you of a kind of perfectionism? Maybe that's not quite the right word, but that because sacrifices had been made and this was hard, that the kids were going to exceed all of our expectations because these sacrifices had been made?
Oh, certainly. I think there was definitely an expectation, maybe not of perfectionism, but professionalism, I might say, you know, to kind of find a job that was secure, that you know, allowed you opportunities for advancement, those kinds of things. You know, I think it was really shocking for my parents to hear me say that I wanted to be a writer. You know, that wasn't one of the job options that they
why not
that they had envisioned for me.
What did they envision, and why wasn't writer on that list?
Oh, you know, I think it's the typical kind of doctor, lawyer, those jobs that they hear about and that they kind of know to be secure. I think for them, they didn't know a lot of people who were writers, didn't understand like the pathway towards reaching that kind of a goal. And it seemed just really kind of, you know, murky for them. And they've been very supportive since then. But I think in the beginning, it was definitely a shock to them.
It's not like my daughter's a lawyer, and so we know exactly what she does every day. That's where the murkiness is?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like how do you spend your days, but also, you know, how do you build a life? How do you kind of maintain this kind of a career over an extended period of time?
It's a fair question. What's the good answer to that?
I mean, the good answer is that, you know, if it's kind of the thing that you know that you're meant to do and that your heart wants to do, that it's worth pursuing and that you can build a life out of it. But it might not look the way a typical life does, you know.
And you're okay with that. You're more than okay with that, probably.
I'm more than okay with that, yes.
I mean, you've had a lot of success, though, with this novel, but it is the nature, right, of the artist to think, but then what about the next time and the next time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think you kind of are always thinking about next steps and about, you know, kind of how to sustain your career, definitely.
I'm having a conversation this hour with Yaa Jessie. She's the author of a new novel that's getting a lot of attention. It's called Homegoing. And you hear us pulling out these ideas of Yaa's experience of knowing that her family came from Ghana. She was quite young when the family emigrated to the United States, but wanting to go back there and setting this novel, this first novel, in that place, in some other landscapes, but doing some research in Ghana and working back to the idea of what it means when your family tree goes back into some places that you know a lot about or you don't, what it means when a family history is erased. And that leads me to ask you this morning as you listen and whether you've gone back to some of the towns of your family ancestors and now you understand more about the tribulations that those people, some of the hard choices that they made. And maybe that informs you more about your own identity, your family identity. As I say, I know we have a lot of Scandinavians here, maybe some Eastern or Middle European people. Have you had that experience of going back and saying, okay, now I know better about who we are? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. If you can fit it into 140 characters, I can read it on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR, and stuff off the page.
Yeah, Mark wrote in to nprnews.org/live. He says, my grandfather was born in the late 1800s in Iowa. He was abandoned as a child at 8. He survived on his own, worked in a circus.
Lived what? This sounds like a novel. This sounds like Yaa's next novel.
What? Wait for it. Lived with hobos, then enlisted in World War I. In talking about our family tree with our kids, it was hard to explain how we just don't know what happened. Not sure why, but no one ever really wanted and or was willing to talk about it, and the few stories seem to have mutated over time. That said, despite research, the lineage just stops. Sad and odd at best.
Okay, so abandoned at 8, in a circus, with hobos, World War I.
That's right.
I hope there are some kind of journals or something in that family.
There's nothing else. They just don't know.
That he knows about that. Yeah, I think I read that you kept a family tree or you built a family tree for all these multi-generations that you were building into the novel. Is that true? Near your writing desk?
Yeah, that's true. When I first started writing this novel, I created a family tree, and it looks much like the one that's at the front of the novel today. You know, it just had the character's name and the year that they were born and where they lived, and it kind of just allowed me to see this family in all of its complexity and to kind of write them into existence.
This is complicated. So I've opened the novel to this page with the family tree. Right. Were you... how much of the tree came first? And then you would, you know, add on as you were developing the ideas of the novel. How'd that work?
So I started with the first two characters, the half-sisters, Afia and Essie. And those two chapters I kind of wrote right away. And then I made the family tree. And really, the whole family tree came fully formed. And it was kind of just based off of these characters, these different branches that I started to develop stories that might fit who that person was and where they lived and what time they were living in.
You knew that three generations on, this is where this character would be. You knew that early on?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah, I did.
How did you know that?
I mean, I knew I wanted to kind of toggle back and forth between Ghana and America, kind of focusing mostly on the American South and kind of focusing on these two regions of Ghana, the central region and the Ashanti region. And so once I had that kind of in my head, it was easy to come up with the place, at least. And also because I knew I wanted to end in America in the present day, it was easy to know that the last Ghanaian character would be an African immigrant. So those kinds of things kind of fell in place as I was making the family tree.
Call here from Anne in White Bear Lake. Hi, Anne. What's your family story?
Well, I was just intrigued with your interview because my husband was, he's Cuban born, he's a Cuban refugee, but he left Cuba more than 50 years ago under what they call the Peter Pan plan. And he was, you know, he's an only child away from his parents for 5 years. They finally got out after about 5 years in the late 60s. But we've been able to go back to visit several times in the last 5 years. And it's been very hard, very difficult because of the destruction within the country, trying to locate records on family members, almost impossible, and in some cases totally impossible because of the destruction of these records. Often names were changed when people migrated to Cuba. And when your last name is De Lille, which means of the island, it could mean anything. You know that you're French, but, you know, that's all you know.
Right.
And it's been, it's just really been very heartbreaking.
Does he still have family, Anne, in Cuba that, he gets together with?
Well, yes, we do. We have a few cousins. He was an only child to parents in their 40s. And so most, even though he came, both sides of the family from very large families, you know, 12 children, that kind of thing. Most of the aunts and uncles, well, all of them were deceased. So all he has left now are a few cousins who we have visited in several cities on the island. And that's, you know, been wonderful, but
but there's a lot of, there are a lot of pieces missing.
Many. I mean, we wanted to go to the famous cemetery in La Habana to, you know, see where his grandparents, et cetera, and uncles and whatnot were buried. Nobody knows where they're buried.
Wow.
It's just, it's and you can't, unless you know exact dates, you can't even begin to approximate where the place may be, where they rest. And so it's been wonderful in some ways, and in other ways, just horribly sad and depressing.
I appreciate the call, Anne. And I wish you luck on those future trips into Cuba to piece together more of the family. To Tony in Minneapolis. Tony, you've been back to Ghana, is that right?
Yeah. I just took my kids to Ghana for the summer. We came back last Monday, and we, originally my family from Togo. Togo and Ghana are the countries that borders, and we go back and forth. We are from, I mean, we go back and forth. Families are divided with these colonial powers, divided the country into those things. So we have family both sides. Originally, we're from Togo, and we, my parents, my grandparents immigrated to Ghana. So my, I took my two kids, and they spent 2 months in both countries. We went back and forth, and they enjoyed it. We even
great.
Visited the castle, the Cape Coast castle.
The castle.
We went there. We went to Akosombo Dam, and they can't believe that we have kids in Ghana. They enjoyed it. They met a lot of families. They made a lot of friends.
Tony,
even right now,
hey, Tony, you brought up the castle. Sorry to interrupt, but I want to talk to y'all about that because that's an important element in the storytelling. Yeah, where I think you two are talking about the same castle, yes?
Yeah. So the Cape Coast Castle is in Cape Coast in the central region of Ghana, and it was kind of the, you know, the seat of British power during colonialism.
And it plays an important, well, I guess it's an important, I guess, storytelling point, I would say, without telling too much. You see, I'm struggling not to give too much away. What's the impression that it made on you to include it in the story the way you did?
Oh, I mean, it's kind of indescribable touring this castle. You know, I took the tour and the guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle during this time would sometimes marry the local women. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And really, I think all of us on that tour would probably agree that we were just kind of struck with these mixed emotions of rage and grief and just kind of a deep sadness to kind of think about the fact that were people kept in these dungeons for months at a time waiting for this uncertain future.
How much did you know about the slave trade in Ghana? I mean, who it was that was supplying slaves to American and British slave traders? Before you got there, how much did you know about it?
You know, I knew very little. I mean, I knew that these castles were on Ghanaian soil, not just the Cape Coast Castle, but castles like Elmina. And I knew that we had to have been involved with it in some way. But it was really on this tour that I started to hear about the different ways that Ghanaians themselves were involved in the slave trade. And it really made an impression on me.
A call here from Sophie in Chaska. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Hey, what's your experience of going back to learn more about your family?
Yeah, so my dad's side of the family is Armenian. Mm-hmm. And so my great-grandparents came from Western Armenia, which is now Eastern Turkey. And they escaped the genocide during the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And I was actually able to go to Armenia last summer for 4 months.
4 months? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
On a birthright trip to volunteer and learn about these people who, you know, are supposedly my people. Because there's a very there's a big sense of pride among Armenians, like, you are Armenian, you belong to Armenia. And I got there and I was like, well, this isn't really the land where my grandparents came from. This is modern Armenia that went through the Soviet era. And my great grandparents were probably more Turkish. So it's been a really interesting trying to figure out if I feel connected to a physical place and how Armenia fits modernly into the world. I do feel way more Armenian now that
do
I
you?
Was able to go back for so long. Huh. And I'm really proud of that. It's just a very interesting thing. I was expecting to feel like, oh, I should move back to Armenia, like, let's go back to Armenia. But I've never been there. My family never lived there. So, yeah.
Sophie, I appreciate the call. You've kind of raised a question for me with Yah, which is, had you been back to Ghana, Yah, before you got the research grant to go research the novel?
Yes, I went back once with my entire family the summer after sixth grade. So I think I was about 11. And that was my first trip back since leaving when I was 2. And it was really formative in that I got to meet, you know, my aunts and uncles and my grandparents, people who I had obviously known when I was a baby, but I had no memory of them.
I wondered if it sounded, it smelled, it looked the way you thought it would once you were an adult, when you went back on this research trip. I mean, I heard a little bit of dissonance there from Sophie with this experience of going back to Armenia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it did in a lot of ways remind me of that trip when I was 11, but in a lot of ways it was different too. I think just because I was older and I was kind of coming for different purposes, you know, I was coming by myself for research rather than with my family to reconnect. And so I think I was kind of bringing a different eye to my experience of the country than I had been prior.
Yah Jesse is with us, part of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series, which I am sorry to say is kind of winding down here towards the end of August, but some great novels between now and then. And hers is one of them. It's called Homegoing. You can read about it on the thread. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll continue our conversation. And I'd love to hear from more of you about trips back to the homeland where you learned more about your family's history and what it says about your family identity, who you think you are. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Chicago's police superintendent says he will recommend the firing of 7 officers involved in the shooting death of black teenager Laquan McDonald. Superintendent Eddie Johnson says he's accepting the recommendations of the city's inspector general, who concluded the officers filed false police reports. Johnson's recommendation will go to the city's police board for a final decision. Officer Jason Van Dyke is charged with first-degree murder in the 2014 shooting death of McDonald. Video released a year after McDonald's death showed he was not threatening Van Dyke before the officer shot him 16 times at close range. Former Minnesota Vikings Pro Bowl safety Darren Sharper has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for drugging and raping as many as 16 women in four states. Sharper pleaded guilty or no contest to charges in federal court in New Orleans and state courts in Louisiana, Arizona, California, and Nevada. Sharper also played for the Packers and the Saints. A Brazilian police official says American swimmer Ryan Lochte fabricated a story about being robbed at gunpoint in Rio. The official, who was, has direct knowledge of the investigation, says Lochte and three teammates pushed on the door of a locked gas station restroom and broke it, and a security guard appeared and confronted them. The official says the guard was armed with a pistol, but he never took it out or pointed it at the swimmers. That contradicts a story told by Lochte that the swimmers were robbed at gunpoint. And South Korea's army says it has conducted its largest ever artillery drills near the tense border with North Korea. The army says 300 artillery systems along the border began firing shells at the same time today. It says North Korea's military has not shown any signs of a response. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:45.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump comes to Minnesota for a fundraiser. I'm Kathy Werzer. Both parties in the state are using his visit to get their message out. That's Friday on Morning Edition, 4 to 9 a.m. here on NPR News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, the National Park System marks 100 years this month and is now focusing efforts on a major shortfall, the lack of diversity in who visits a park and who works for a park. Hear about the efforts to change that at 11.
Support comes from Sala Architects, committed to creating thoughtfully crafted and intimately connected design solutions for a wide range of architectural projects. More at salaarc.com. Sala Architects, simple, natural, timeless.
Steph Curtis and I are talking about off-air, the next episode in Dog Days of Summer. This has been fun. These are books about dogs and different dogs.
That's right. I'm excited about the next one.
And it's not as superficial and silly as it sounds or sweet.
It's not. No. The next one's we're going to have Blair Braverman on.
Next week.
And she's got, she's a dog sledder.
Yeah.
Not your average dog owner.
Lives north of, is this right? North of Green Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she's traveling to a studio in Green Bay, but she likes it cold. She likes the north. She says that's kind of where her internal compass points true north, so she'll be with us next week. You can find all those Dog Days of Summer conversations on my podcast. It's just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes. Back to this discussion, Yah Jesse with us. The novel is called Homegoing, and we're talking about what that means when a family history gets erased and how it shapes your identity to learn more about your family. And I'm going to grab a call here from Catherine in Wavasha. Catherine, did you have an experience with this?
Well, I'm not African, but I worked in Africa for 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I lived there. And when we lived in Sudan in the early 90s, I would go to the souk, the big groceries, the big open shopping area, and I witnessed slavery there. Your author mentioned slavery in the beginning. After several times of going there to shop, the slave owners allowed me to know in no uncertain terms that I wasn't welcome there, and so I quit going there. But it's the kind of compassion and empathy that we think about when we think about a past time slavery is really difficult to see in the contemporary
modern
world.
Day. Yeah,
and actually, I hardly ever talk about it. But since your author brought it up, I thought I would just add that sort of information. But contemporary slavery still happens.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Yah if that's something that she's familiar with, aware of.
It's not something. Contemporary slavery is not something that I focused on in the book, but I did, spend some time thinking about obviously the legacy of slavery and kind of the lasting effects that it has had on America and in Ghana.
There's a scene in one of the Ghanaian villages where the elders, and again, this is back in the slave trading days of America and Great Britain, the elders are rounding up slaves for the ships, and you've written, trade had increased so much and the methods of gathering slaves had become so reckless that many of the tribes had taken to marking their children's faces so they would be distinguishable. That's chilling. I came back to that paragraph a couple of times to think about the implications of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this was something that came up in my research, the kinds of ways that people would try to avoid being captured. And a lot of them were really quite devastating, including things like marking up your child or hiding them or even killing them. These methods of keeping them from this, again, this violent and uncertain life.
Tribes did this between tribes. That's part of the African story of this. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the different ethnic groups in Ghana and other countries during that time period were kind of exploiting each other as they were being exploited, trying to curry favor with different colonial powers or to just gain a standing. And I think a lot of the rivalries between the different ethnic groups were definitely exploited, and it caused a lot of strife.
You wrote a lot of suffering into this novel. You know that,
yeah.
Right?
yeah, absolutely.
Deliberately.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there really isn't a way to write a book about slavery and its lasting impact and not write about suffering, and to not point a light at all of the different ways that people suffered and were made to suffer and also caused each other to suffer. I think studying slavery and studying this history is kind of just a continual lesson in people's kind of capacity for great evil.
That's true. I also found echoes of the immigration debate and the criminal justice discussion that we're having right now in this country and, in our political arena today. And I thought that probably occurred to you. You were thinking about it as you were spelling out the story.
Oh, absolutely. There's a chapter in this novel, H's chapter, that takes place basically right after H has been arrested for a non-crime and then is sent to work in a coal mine in Alabama. And this is in the 19th century under the convict leasing system, which is something that took place in this country for a very long period of time following the end of the Civil War.
I knew nothing about that. Will you describe what that was?
Yeah, basically the convict leasing system was a system by which typically black men were arrested for things like vagrancy, which basically means nothing. These crimes that could be anything from standing on a corner to looking at a woman to whatever it was. And after they were arrested, they could be sold by their state to private companies. So coal mining companies, railroad companies, whatever it was, basically leased by that state for the duration of their sentencing, 7 years, 9 years, whatever it was. And many of these men died in these mines, serving out these sentences for crimes that we know now were not really crimes at all. And I think this is kind of, telling when you look at the criminalization of black men in America today, that we have this history that we kind of don't talk about, don't know about.
Right.
And bury.
A call here from Judith in Stillwater. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Hey. What's your story with your family?
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my mother's family was Swedish, and I know they came over here because the oldest son would get the land, and then the other kids, if they wanted a farm, they would have to come to America. And so my great-great-grandmother and her husband and her little six-year-old boy came on the boat, and while they were in the North Sea, she was pregnant, and she gave birth and died.
Yeah. She died. She died in childbirth on the boat.
Yeah,
oh,
on the boat, and
wow.
They wrapped her in. This is, I mean, our family, our whole family knows this. They wrapped her in canvas and dropped her into the ocean because they couldn't keep her on the boat.
Oh my
and
gosh.
The baby lived. They must have had another woman nursing, I suppose. And the little 6-year-old boy watching all this was my great grandfather.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And so he told his son, my grandpa, Anderson, and he told me, he said, Judy, if you go to Sweden, you put flowers in the sea for grandma. So, yeah, 3 years ago, my husband and I went to Sweden. Oh, I can't even tell this. And we put flowers in the sea for grandma.
So this is still emotional for you.
I mean, yeah.
Generations back.
When I think of her being 26 years old and dying like that, I have daughters. I can't even begin to think of that.
Oh, I appreciate the call.
You bet.
Yeah, I was curious about, so with all this turning over some stones here in your own family and going back to Ghana, what your parents, who left the country behind, what, 20-something years ago now,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe more.
Yeah.
Well, what do they think of this?
I mean, I think they're, you know, they're incredibly proud of this book, and I think it's also kind of shined a light on aspects of American history that they didn't grow up hearing about, didn't learn in schools, and so they've kind of started to connect to American history in that way. I think it's been a really overwhelmingly positive experience for them, seeing this book out in the world.
Yeah, I guess I was interested in, are they gratified by your deep connection to Ghana? Is this something that was unexpected for them?
Yeah, perhaps so. I don't know if they kind of knew that I had this this interest in Ghana and in our history, and but certainly it's a testament to them and the way that they raised me that I feel so strongly connected to this land, even though I never lived there, or I lived there for such a short period of time, I should say.
So there's a lot of music in the novel. And I'm both curious about how you thought about working it into the novel and then what you listened to. So I will ask you first about why it turns up as often as it does in the book.
Sure. Music is really important to me. I grew up kind of singing in church. And so there's a character in this book, Willie, who sings in church, in the church choir. And so her story kind of, you know, is deeply resonant for me because I can remember doing that. And I always kind of knew that I wanted this book to have a sense of musicality to it, and to kind of reflect not just the music of you know, my homeland, the kind of Ghanaian music, high life music, whatever it is, but also the deeply Black Southern music, gospel music, jazz music, whatever that was, and kind of to be allowed to connect those two forms.
Did you listen to some particular music in the writing of this?
You know, I don't usually listen to music while I'm writing. So there wasn't anything that was, you know, playing as I was writing it. But I was thinking a lot about artists like Billie Holiday and Nina Simone and kind of different artists of those time periods that the book follows.
We thought we might close with some African spiritual music. Is that good?
Yeah,
that
sounds great.
Do you think? Okay, good.
That sounds wonderful.
Really great to have you here. Thank you so much. I'm glad we had the opportunity to do this.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Yah Jesse's novel is called Homegoing. Read about it on the thread. I mentioned seeing all of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series at The Thread. While you're there, can I suggest that you sign up for The Thread newsletter? I write a book essay for it every week. What I'm reading, what I'm thinking about, novels that I love, novels that I didn't like, novels I didn't think I was going to like, and then I ended up liking them. So you can read about that on The Thread when you subscribe to The Thread newsletter. mprnews.org/thread.